The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello and joining you this week from Sóller in Mallorca, sometime home of sometime podcast maestro Rob Hatch. And I learned today, tragically, we're one of two Mallorcans to win the Volta a Catalunya. Antonio Gelabert lost his life in a car accident in 1956. The Volta a Catalunya currently happening just across the Med, of course. My name is Daniel Freiber and I'm the host of this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we're going to tear off three strips of focaccia and mop up the last flecks at the bottom of the proverbial Milan San Remo pesto jar. Helping me to do that are two men who rode La Classicissima at the weekend, or at least two slightly different versions thereof. One completing the 294 kilometres in just under 6.5 hours, having placed his AG2R Citroën leader Benoît Cosnefroy at the bottom of the Poggio like a master jeweller setting the 5-carat diamond in an heiress's engagement ring. The other handily bypassing the first 194-kilometre boring bit, ordering an antipasto primo secondo and dolce at the feed zone, and spending longer than the 5 minutes 38 seconds it took Mathieu van der Poel to climb the Poggio, posing for pictures in the phone box at the top to create what he proudly informed me yesterday was our best performing Instagram post of the year so far. It is respectively the Motown maestro, lucky Larry Warbass, and our very own Lionel Burney. You can guess, you listeners can guess which one was which in those descriptions. How are you both recovering from your respective efforts?
Did you stop in the phone box, Larry? That's the most important thing.
Unfortunately, I didn't see the phone box, no.
You didn't even see it? Shocking. Lionel, it was a very...
No.
You told me it was a very... it was a very popular Instagram post of you in the phone box. But how are you recovering from your efforts in San Remo at the weekend?
I'm fully recovered, apart from a slight... I'm in a house with someone who's suffering from COVID. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that I don't catch COVID. I felt pretty rough yesterday, to be honest, but that's just the way it is. This winter seems to be just one illness after another. I must admit, I do wonder how pro riders, pro athletes of any kind with young children manage, because your immune system just seems to take a hammering. They go through nursery school and catch every single bug going. If I was a pro rider, I'd probably go and live in Tenerife and keep away from the bugs and germs.
Larry, of course, you don't have children, do you? But you have a dog, Larry. I must make a guilty confession, Larry. I saw your dog on the Saturday, Paris-Nice. I saw it at the top of the mountain. Your dog and your girlfriend were waiting for you at the finish. They were both in AG2R kit, weren't they? And I didn't stop to introduce myself to either the dog or your girlfriend.
Damn.
Partly because I'm not a dog person. I always feel a bit uneasy around people who really love dogs, because they can kind of see the sort of, in my case, the total indifference
terror
towards
in your eyes.
Well, there's the terror and the total indifference. And I always, there's a kind of deflation. I can see how deflated they are when you don't share their love for dogs.
I mean, he's a dog for not dog people. Like, even if you don't like dogs, you like Blanco. He's just the chillest, coolest dog. Like, I don't know. Anyway.
Larry,
you would have liked him if you met him.
Well, that day, where we were at the Col la Cuyol in the Mercantour Alps. And you're in the Mercantour Alps at the moment because you're up at altitude, aren't you, in Isola 2000?
I am, yeah. So not too far away from that
stage. You don't look
thrilled about it. Oh, no, it's pretty nice. It's beautiful blue skies. It's really nice up here right now, so that's good.
Lionel, have I ever told my Charlie Gore Isola 2000 story on the podcast? It's not a very good story. When I graduated from university in 2003, I was trekking across the Alps, and I spent a couple of days at Isola 2000. I saw Charlie Gore, I was convinced I saw Charlie Gore anyway. And
I don't know who Charlie Gore is.
You don't know who Charlie Gore is? Winner of the 1956.
He was nicknamed the Angel of the Mountains. He won the 1958 Tour de France, and one of the kind of, for anyone who got into cycling in the 50s, like my dad, he was kind of the poster boy for some reason. Kind of captured everything that European cycling was, you know, is kind of romantic compared to the kind of the metronomic Jacques Anquetil.
Yeah, and this was quite a big deal me seeing Charlie Gall, Larry, because Charlie Gall became a mythical figure, not least because there was this sort of, it was a bit of an urban legend about him having completely disappeared and become literally a hermit, a recluse, and gone to live in a cabin in the forests of the Ardennes in Luxembourg, where he was from. So, you know, me
saying, I thought you were going to say in a cabin in Isla 2000,
well,
which
yeah.
is probably a good place to be.
You seen any, before we get on with the news roundup, the other thing I remember, I always think of when I think of Isla 2000 is the ibexes. They were fantastic. There were a lot of ibexes up there just above Isla on the Codola Lombard.
Yeah, there are. It's actually cool. I was here in the summer and did like a little backpacking tour with my girlfriend, and we saw like some crazy wildlife and ibex, and it was really cool.
Lionel, shall I crack on with the news roundup?
Yeah, do it.
And we'll start with sort of off the bike stuff this week. A few weeks ago, we featured an interview with the former Australian rider Alan Piper, who helped guide Tadej Pogacar to Tour de France victory in 2020 as a director sportif with UAE. But since withdrawn from that role due to health issues, the reason we spoke to Alan at the time was that he and UAE had seemingly found an agreement for him to return to the team in a consultancy role this year. However, we've learned in the last couple of days that will not now happen. The team released a statement quoting Piper. He said he thanked Mauro Ginetti, the team manager in UAE, for trying to reincorporate him into the squad. But my vision of the collaboration was different from those of all my visions. Of the collaboration were different from those of the team. He wished the team all the best going forward. It seems as though it was a pretty sort of amicable agreement that they weren't going to work together, but that's a bit of a shame, isn't it, chaps? I think not least because, well, we know about Alan Piper's health problems over the last couple of years, and seemed like a happy conciliation. Another bit of news in brief, something we may well revisit in the Giro d'Italia in a few weeks. The two-time Giro champion Beppe Saronni has reignited his four-decade-long feud with Francesco Moser by blasting Moser from... Larry, do you know who Francesco Moser and Giuseppe Saronni are?
Yeah, him okay. I know, yeah. He's a winemaker, right?
There, well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
By blasting Moser in an interview with Il Corriere della Sera, perhaps most notably, Saronni said that Moser had a monopoly on the blood transfusions administered by Professor Francesco Conconi in the 80s, which were legal at the time, but said Saronni were a gateway to many of the problems which blighted cycling later. In spite of their rivalry, Saronni admitted that he still buys wine from Moser's cantina and that it's excellent. He added, though, that he never looks closely at the bill, although he doubts Moser gives him a discount. This was like a nice warm blanket, this story, because there's less and less of this in cycling. Moser Saronni is one of the great old Italian beefs, the great feuds. I thought this would be a good cue to ask Larry about. Are there any feuds, Larry? Are there any beefs that we don't know about that we really should know about? This is your opportunity to lift the lid. Do you have any feuds?
Oh, me? Just Hugh Carthy.
Oh, yes, we know about
that
one.
You guys know that one already. I'd have to think about it. I'm not really sure.
Well, maybe there are probably
a few that exist. But yeah, usually it's like one guy has a lot of feuds with a lot of guys, you know? It's not like individuals a lot of times,
I did think it was interesting, you know, the footage of the aftermath of Milano Sanremo and the three riders from the podium all squeezed onto that too small sofa, and it was Van Aert went up first to go onto the podium. They'd all sat there in a kind of awkward silence, like strangers packed onto a commuter train or something, and trying not to touch thighs together, no eye contact. And then when Van Aert went up to the podium, suddenly Ganna and Van der Poel were warm, and they moved apart a little bit to be more comfortable on the sofa, but sort of started to engage in conversation. And I think this rivalry between Van der Poel and Van Aert is very well understood. They've been going head to head since they were children, really, haven't they? And I think there was a piece that Pete Cozins, our colleague, wrote this week, just talking about that rivalry. And one of them said basically that the rivalry is such that they can't really be friends. And I kind of get that. You know, they're going up against each other. They've got to try and bury each other on the road. They can certainly respect each other, but I'm sure they're not going to be dinner party guests until after they've retired, maybe.
No. No, I mean, it's fairly thin gruel, though, that rivalry, I would say, compared to Moser and Saronni. As I said, hopefully we'll revisit this in the Giro d'Italia because it is a great story that we probably haven't done enough on over the years. Should we talk about some racing? There were three French Cup races, so there have been in the last few days. The GP Dona last Wednesday, the Classic Loire Atlantique, and the GP Cholet, Pays de la Loire, at the weekend. Those three races were won respectively by Juan Sebastian Molano of UAE, Axel Zangler of Cofidis, and Laurence Pithy. I was tempted to pronounce that in a French way, but he's a New Zealander, and he rides for Groupama. Pithy is he's 20 years old, and he was also second the previous day. Larry, French Cup, big deal for French teams, not a big deal at all for a lot of fans that follow cycling. How important is the French Cup for AG2R Citroën?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty important, you know, like they used to win it like almost every year, and you know, it was always kind of a big deal if they could win it. I know it's like big for the sponsor and stuff, just like there's something in French teams where it's like it's really important to be the best French team, and so if you win the French Cup, then you know, you're kind of like the best French team, right? So
it used to be huge for Cofidis back 10, 15 years ago. It was almost their biggest objective of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you can't win big World Tour race, you might as well try to win the French Cup.
Shots fired.
No.
Biggest feud in cycling. I mean, Larry, you know, Warbus versus Cofidis is the feud about.
No. I mean, it's not the same Cofidis as it used to be. They've, you know, definitely grown a lot. But you know, I don't know. It's funny because like before you're on a French team, you're just like, what are these races? You never even heard of them before, you know? And then like on the team, they're like important big races, you know? So it's like to get like on the French races and stuff is like, you know, it's tough. So yeah, for our team, it's quite important. And I think it's just, you know, anytime racing at home is always important for the team.
We should also mention another one-day race that happened last week, and that was Nokere-Kursa. Lotta Kopecky won the women's race there. Tim Merlier was the best of the men. Speaking of women's racing, moving to the weekend, last weekend, that is, the Tour de Normandie was won by a Breton, I believe, Cédrine Kerbaol. By 1 second, she won from her compatriot Gladys Verhulst. Two significant men's stage races are happening at the moment, the Settimana Coppa Bartali in central Italy and the aforementioned Volta a Catalunya, aka Spain's oldest stage race, first ridden in 1911. In Coppa Bartali, Remy Cavagna won stage one after a 32-kilometer solo break, but has lost the leader's jersey to his teammate Mauro Schmidt today. Schmidt was second on stage two behind your compatriot Larry, Sean Quinn. In Catalunya, stage one was Roglified. I think you all know what that means. Well, stage two saw a Roglicide. Primoz finishing second. Well, you could say that Giulio Ciccone Roglified him. At the time of recording today, stage three has just concluded atop La Molina. And guess what? Rog got Remco-sized. Did you see that, chaps? Were you watching? And
I turned it on when you told me that you were watching the final. So, yeah.
Well, an appetite.
I watched the last 5K or something.
Yeah, it's a sort of foretaste of the. It's been billed, hasn't it, as a bit of a dress rehearsal for the Giro d'Italia, and they're certainly. Well, Remco and Roglic are both going to the Giro. They will both be favourites, and they look pretty closely matched at the moment, I would say. Although I think today was maybe indicative of what we've seen so far. Evenepoel looks slightly stronger. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting, that, isn't it? In a race where there'll be time bonuses and plenty of opportunities on those sorts of finishes, the pair of them going head-to-head. Evenepoel, obviously, quicker today and, just failed to take the leader's jersey. I think Roglic has kept the leader's jersey, but they're tied on time. So,
well, it was a cock-up, wasn't it, by Remco, because he celebrated. He lost at least 2 seconds with his celebration. He sat up. and saluted the crowd at least 50 metres before the line, I would say.
But there's plenty of opportunities for more showdown between Rog and Remco later on this week. The thing that was interesting for me about was to see Richard Carapaz in the early break.
Yeah, Carapaz had lost. He'd lost time, didn't he, on stage two of the mountaintop finish. There were a couple of riders were well off the pace. Egan Bernal got dropped fairly early on stage two as well, but climbed pretty creditably nonetheless. Finished about 2 minutes down. He's coming back from knee injury, of course. But yeah, it's always. I mean, it's a big old. It's a tough stage race, isn't it, the Volta a Catalunya? And for some riders, these are the first long climbs that they've done all season. There are always some big casualties in that first mountaintop finish. I mean, there are others, for example, there have been other significant time losses by pre-race favourites. For example, Adam Yates in the first stage, but he was involved in a really nasty crash, which I should also mention cost Dario Cataldo of Trek Segafredo, broken elbow, I think it was, or it might have been multiple broken bones, so we wish him all the best.
Yeah, I mean, this is Carapaz's first stage race of the season as well, remember? I mean, he won the Ecuadorian Road Race Championships. His first race in Europe was Milano-Torino last week, and yeah, first stage race of the season. His eyes will be very much on the summer, the Dauphiné, the Tour de France, so just an early hit out for him, I guess, a stretch of the legs. But it's good to see riders of that stature in an early break like that. I thought it added a bit more to the early hours of my double screening today with the Brugge de Panna Classic on one screen and Catalunya on the other. I mean, this is traditionally the busiest week of the cycling season, isn't it? It's where the kind of the twin lanes start to merge together. All eyes will be on the cobbled classics from this point on.
Well, I was about to say, Lionel, you are our de facto cobbled classics correspondent. Can you tell us briefly what happened in De Panna?
I can, yeah. Well, I mean, it was a really good race. I think the we'll talk about this in the third part with Larry, but I'm not a big fan of that circuit. I think it's a dangerous course. It's the only one of those Flemish classics, the major ones in the World Tour, I think, that's not part of Flanders Classics. And the course has kind of evolved from the days when this was a three-day stage race. Now it's a one-day race on a kind of glorified Kermesse circuit. I mean, I've described it variously in the past as a bit like a sort of bumper car circuit at the fairground. Some of the street furniture is ridiculous. That left-hand turn on the finishing circuit on the cobbles across that narrow bridge and then onto more cobbles gives me the heebie-jeebies every time. Oddly, because the weather was bad and the wind was up and there were crosswinds and it split into pieces, it actually made it safer, I think, for the majority of riders because it wasn't 150 riders all trying to get to the front. From quite a long way out, it split up into small groups, and that also made it a much better race. And well, the shakedown came 16 kilometers from the finish when Jasper Philipsen, who's one of a number of very fast finishers in that group of, well, originally it was about 35 riders, and then it split down to 16 or 18 riders, but Philipsen sort of ghosted off the front. He had Olav Koy of Jumbo Visma on his wheel, and the Soudal Quickstep rider who marked him was Yves Lampaert. Soudal Quickstep had a number of riders. They were the best represented in that group of 18, but Fabio Jakobsen was not across in that group. Suboptimal for Soudal Quickstep because Lampaert was never going to beat Philipsen or Koy in a sprint. So we had this curious sight of the Soudal Quickstep riders chasing a group with their own teammate in it. Normally, the rule is you don't chase when you've got a teammate in the break, but with Lampaert having little chance, really, of beating Philipsen in the sprint, it made sense for Soudal Quickstep to try and close the gap. They couldn't. The other rider in that front quartet was Frédéric Frison of Lotto Destiny. He tried a couple of moves to pull a fast one at the finish, but was unsuccessful. And Philipsen finished it off in the sprint. Quite impressive by the Alpecin De Koninck rider because he did make that move happen. He didn't just sit in and wait for the sprint. I mean, he was, you know, presumably trying to reduce his competition because in that group, Groenewegen, Ackermann, Jakobsen, as I mentioned, but it was a really good edition of that race. And yeah, I think because of the bad weather, made it much less of a kind of one of those ones that you sort of watch through your fingers thinking anything, something bad could happen at any moment. But a bit in common with a couple of years ago when it was held in October as a result of the COVID interruption, the weather was terrible that day and it finished with Yves Lampaert winning solo. And that likewise was a really compelling race to watch in bad weather. But when the weather's nice and the wind doesn't blow, I just think that it's like, yeah, it's like putting the riders on some kind of bowling alley and seeing which of the skittles stay upright.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. They've been supporting us for the past couple of seasons and they've been in the news a lot in recent weeks because of the situation that arose from the women's Strada Bianca recently when Kristen Faulkner was stripped of her third place for wearing a continuous glucose monitoring device under her jersey. Of course, they're not allowed in competition. First of all, Kristen Faulkner issued a statement saying, "It was not my intent to violate any rules or gain an unfair advantage. I'm proud of how I raced Strada Bianca and I'm extremely disappointed in the UCI's decision. I also hope that one day glucose monitors are allowed in racing. I believe they are a valuable tool for athletes, especially women, to take care of our physical health." Though that is a conversation for another time. And Super Sapiens also issued a statement in which they urged the UCI to work together with Super Sapiens and others to collaborate, establishing data sets and continued scientific learnings with the goal of designing science-based best practices for optimizing nutrition and recovery and mitigating eating disorders. Strada Bianca, of course, Cecily Uttrup-Ludwig was elevated to third place. And, well, Larry, I wondered if you had a view on whether at some point these devices will be allowed in races.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to say, you know. I think, one, it's a big shame for Kristen Faulkner that she was disqualified. You know, I think she did a great race. And, you know, I don't think she meant any harm by wearing her continuous glucose monitor. But, yeah, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see how it goes forward in the future, because if they do change the rule, I think that could change a lot of things. You know, I think, you know, right now it's continuous glucose monitors, but I think it'll have more to do with other things. I know, you know, I think one thing they might be working on is like a continuous lactate monitor, which would be really, really interesting. And so I think if they allowed the continuous glucose monitors, they might have to allow the lactate ones too when those eventually do come out. And I think that might be a bit more of a performance advantage. So I don't know if we'll see that being permitted. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting case and it's an interesting topic. But, you know, I think the UCI is probably going to stick to their guns on this one. And unfortunately, I don't think we'll see any progression there with that rule.
Well, no, it was an open and shut case, really, as far as Kristen Faulkner was concerned. Just very quickly, Larry, have you actually had a go with a continuous glucose monitor?
Yeah, so I've tried the Super Sapiens a few times, actually, and it's interesting. It's you know, there's like a lot of data that you get out of it. But for me, I've found like I've never really had, I guess, good guidance on sort of how to use it or what the results mean, because it's really interesting to see, you know, certain things like maybe, I mean, some things are logical, but if you eat like a couple Haribo, you see a big spike, you know. But the other things that are really interesting is like when you're in training is every hard effort you do, you get a big spike. So it's not just from what you eat, it's from what you do on the bike. And even, you know, I heard a story of another rider I know. He was wearing one and they were at team camp. And right when it was time to have his meeting with all the directors, he had a huge spike on his CGM monitor, which, you know, is kind of funny as well. So yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think there are some uses for it, but
was it Dombrowski before he scheduled meeting with Vino?
No, actually, it was like a couple of years ago. It wasn't when he was on Astana, but yeah. So,
well, stress, anxiety does cause those readings to spike. I mean, just before recording our Giro episodes last year, when I was wearing the device, my levels would go up as well. Full transparency, we are sponsored by Super Sapiens. If you want to find out more about how the system works, go to supersapiens.com. Now, before we push on, the latest episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is being produced as we speak and will be out very shortly. Orla and Lizzie Banks joining Rose Manley, of course, to recap the racing and look ahead to the Cobbled Classics. I've given Orla one name there as if she transcends the need for a surname. That's Orla Shenoui, of course. But the Cycling Podcast Feminine will be out very shortly.
Well, Lionel, we've already done one podcast this week, haven't we? We did an Arrivé after Milan-San Remo, and I promised once we had published Arrivé that we would do a much deeper dive into Milan-San Remo, a deeper dive of sorts, guided by someone who rode Milan-San Remo, the real Milan-San Remo at the weekend. A dive so deep you'd need flippers and a snorkel, so that's what we'll proceed to do now with Lucky Larry. Larry, I said that I noticed you were very much centre stage as the race came into the Poggio. You did an expert job of placing your team captain, Benoît Cosnefroid. Let's start at the beginning. I want you to tell us about your day and maybe go back even further. I mean, Milan-San Remo, is it a race that you wanted to do, that you feel you were suited for? I mean, what was the sort of the discussion around you and Milan-San Remo this year?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really nice race. I like to do it. And now that it ended up, we kind of like rearranged my schedule a little bit. Then it was great because like before I was supposed to do Basque Country. And I was like, if I do San Remo and Basque Country, I don't really have much time in between the Giro. So they took me out of Basque Country for the moment. So that's a plus. And then I was happy to do San Remo, you know. I went there to help Benoît. So I sort of on the team, I've kind of been sort of integrated into Benoît's program. And for him, like Milan-San Remo was like a really big objective. So he and the team like wanted me there, which is nice. And it's a really nice race to do. It's cool. I love racing in Italy. And then it's also close to home. And, you know, there's a lot of history behind the race. So yeah, I enjoy doing the race. Unfortunately, we didn't get the result that we came there for. I guess it just didn't really work out for Benoît in the end. You know, I guess you could see on the Poggio, whether it was down to tactics or legs, you know, it was maybe a little bit of a combination of both.
Before we talk about the sort of key part of the race for as far as Benoît and as far as you were concerned, because I guess your job just watching the race, I suppose your job was concentrated mainly around Cipressa and Poggio, but just take us back to the sort of scene, the atmosphere on the bus. It's a very early start for you guys, isn't it? I mean, what time did you set the alarm?
6:45 wake up. I don't forget that because it's like way earlier than you're like, oh God, 6:45. Are you serious? You know, like, I mean,
is that the earliest of the season?
No,
it probably is, isn't it?
I mean, for like maybe a one day race. Yeah. But, sometimes in the Grand Tours, you end up having these crazy long transfers and every once in a while, like I know in the Giro once we had like maybe a 5-something AM wake up, to do some 2-hour transfer after some 3 7-hour stages to go for another long stage that we ended up protesting for, you know, but that one was earlier.
As you want to do. Yeah. And Larry, is it still enormous bowls of pasta?
No, so this is actually something that I wanted to talk about was like, so it used to be, you know, you would eat like, I mean, a horse, you know, you would just wolf down bowl of pasta. You know, I heard some story about like when they were on BMC, Alessandro Ballan, like they had some competition of how many plates of pasta they could eat the night before. And I think Ballan ate something like 7 or 10 plates of pasta, you know? Well, right. It was like this time we were measuring, you know, our 350 grams of cooked pasta that we got, you know, the night before. So, Cycling's definitely changed a lot. You know, we're really a lot more calculated with all the nutrition stuff. And so, yeah, I guess now what they've realized is like just carbo loading the night before isn't necessarily the answer. You kind of like...
You take on a lot more calories during the race, don't you? Now you we eat a ton more during the race.
But then also like what they found is that like to store your glycogen stores, you know, like once you stock them up, they're not really going down that much, you know? So like the days before, as long as you're eating like a high carbohydrate diet in the few days leading up to the race, the day before isn't necessarily so crazy important. It's not like you need to eat 12 plates of pasta the night before the race because you had pasta, you know, the couple days before sort of, you know? So we just kind of, I guess, had a higher carb intake the days before, but nothing really crazy. You know, everything now is like super measured. We had like, you know, a plan from the nutritionist. And yeah, now we have like food scales at the table and we're weighing everything. So yeah, I think I ate something like 350 grams of pasta the night before, you know, and then, you know, had a sizable breakfast. And then, yeah, like in the race, even I didn't eat as much as I eat in some other races because our nutritionist said that with such a long race, it's also not super intense at the start, that he didn't want like to take the risk of if we tried to fuel up to 120 grams an hour, which is what we would do in like, say, a really hard stage of Paris-Nice or something. Over 7 hours, maybe it would cause trouble by the final to digest all that. So we were eating between like 60 to 80 grams an hour the first 2 hours and then a little bit more the last 4 hours. So...
I mean,
pretty calculated. And
yeah, and that, well, in those first couple of hours of Milan San Remo, there are two sort of alternative views of what those hours are like in the peloton. Sometimes you hear, I remember having a conversation with Mark Cavendish and him saying that it's a race where every millimetrical movement counts at some point. It will count 7 hours later. So, you know, those first 2 hours are important in terms of economy. And yet, on the other hand, we hear things like, I mean, I said last week that Matej Mohorovic last year was going around the peloton horse to his friends, his Slovenian friends. He was making jokes about, you know, whether there were good hospitals in Milan San Remo because he knew the risk that he was going to take later on. And we, you know, we might imagine that it's a fairly sort of a whimsical kind of cruise down across the plains of Lombardy and Piedmont towards the coast. And it's one of those rare occasions when it is quite relaxed in the peloton. I mean, how did you approach it and where does the truth lie, Larry?
Yeah, I mean, it's more the second. Like, it's pretty chill. You know, we don't go very hard until, like, you get closer to the Turchino. So pretty much the first hours, like the breakaway goes quick. And then the only thing was this year, and it's happened like some of the other years, is like there's a little bit of wind, you know, it's like an annoying cross headwind so that like you're kind of like single or double file in the peloton. So it's just an annoying pace that like you can't just ride in the wind and talk to your friends. You know, it's not like the bunch is like one big bubble. It's just kind of like almost single or double file. So at that point, you just kind of stay next to your team and it's a little bit boring. You know, you just kind of sit there and don't really, you just ride and it's not that hard. But like, yeah, it's just like the annoying pace and annoying amount of wind that like, it's not like you're just sitting around chatting with your friends, which happens in some races, or if there was like a block headwind that would have happened. But yeah, with the wind and stuff, it was just like, in the end, you just kind of sit next to your team and everyone sits there, just kind of riding along until the Turchino, and then the fight starts. And yeah, it's a fight for position a bit, and everyone's throwing elbows a bit, and you want to be in good position for the descent. And then everyone stops for a pee at the bottom of the descent anyway. So it's kind of a funny race.
What was the wind like when you got onto the coast?
We had like a raging tailwind. So, I mean, it wasn't like it was super, super hard or anything, but we were going, I was like, wow, I feel like we're going really fast. And we were just on the flat going through this town and I looked down and we were going 65K an hour. And I was like, okay, yeah, like this is, I mean, it was just super, super fast. So yeah, it was a strong tailwind, I guess.
And Larry, it's 294 kilometres it was on Saturday. It's obviously by far the longest one-day race of the season. Are you intimidated by that distance in the morning, and are riders generally intimidated by that distance, would you say?
I think, like, in the past, we've always sort of been intimidated by it. But if you actually look at the amount of, like, work you do in the race in terms of, like, kilojoules and stuff, like, it's actually way easier than any other classic. You know, it's like the average watts or something, for example, they aren't super high. It's just there's two extremely hard efforts right at the end. And that's what makes really the big difference there. So yeah, it's not like a Liège or a Flanders or something where it's just super hard the whole day. It's just like there's really two super hard efforts and then a lot of fight for positioning.
And we talked about your role for Cosnefroid. Now, we didn't really talk about Cosnefroid in our preview a couple of weeks ago, but I remembered subsequently that I'd read an interview with Benoît Cosnefroid in Vélo magazine, in which he talked about what he saw as his biggest forte as a bike rider, his biggest point of difference, distinction. And I think he said something like the two-minute efforts and then sustaining that effort or sort of reaching a plateau and remaining, you know, on that same high plateau. And he sort of said that that was what he'd done. He won Montreal last year, didn't he? Montreal in Canada. And when he said that, or when I remembered that statement, I thought, okay, this is maybe a guy who, although he hadn't had good results in San Remo before, he's a guy who could do well on the Poggio. I mean, what was the team plan, broadly speaking?
Yes, I mean, the team plan was sort of like, I mean, it was definitely watch out for Benoît, you know, make sure they're in good position. But then also Ollie, he's been second there before, and he showed that he was going really well the last stage Paris-Nice.
Oliver Nelson.
Yeah. And then Andrea Vendrama had also a bit of a free role because, like, he's good at, like, a punchy sprint kind of thing. So it was like the rest of us were to help, and we had two guys for the earlier parts of the race, which were like Jaakko Hanninen and Lawrence Nossen. And then it was Stan De Wolf and I for sort of like the approach to the Cipressa. And then if we made it over the Cipressa, you know, before the Poggio. And then, those guys obviously just do their best in terms of like a result. So, that was kind of what happened. The pace on the Cipressa was like high, but not as crazy as last year. So we made it over with, I think five guys actually on the team. And, and so then in the end, like, yeah, we kind of, you know, I was going to try to help the guys, but, Benoît was like more comfortable just to follow the leader. So he just stayed on like, Van Aert's wheel. And then like, in the end, like my job was kind of done, and then we hit the bottom of the Poggio, and then that was it, you know? So, and then unfortunately, yeah, I mean, if you watch closely, like he got gapped by Trontin, which I don't know if that was on purpose or he just also was suffering. And then there was like a bit of hesitation, and then that was how those like five, six guys went away, and the race was done for at least our team after that.
You mentioned the pace on the Cipressa. I mean, that was set by UAE. Was there any talk? We again, in last week's pod or 2 weeks ago, we talked about a number of riders who are based in Monaco and riders who sort of practice on the Poggio and practice on the Cipressa, particularly Pogacar. He seemed to have a pretty clear plan. When I spoke to him at Paris-Nice, he talked about the plan that he had, and he'd gone and sort of enacted this plan in training. Was there any talk on the grapevine down there on the Côte d'Azur, Larry, on the promenade, you know, where you hang out in Cannes and places like that, Beaulieu-sur-Mer, about what UAE and Pogacar were plotting? Was there any surprises for you in what they did try to do?
No, I mean, I didn't really hear anything, but I didn't really ask anyone, you know. But in my head, when I kind of watched like what happened last year, I didn't think they were going to go as full gas again this year because it didn't work last year, you know. So I was like, maybe this year they're going to try a different tactic, and maybe their tactic would be to like stay with more guys to the bottom of the Poggio. So in my head, even though that's not like what the team thought or whatever, my personal opinion was that I didn't think they were going to go full up the Cipressa because I think they wanted to have more guys to try to like, you know, stomp the bottom of the Poggio for Pogacar. But in the end, I think they did try to make it hard. I just think they didn't have the guys to make it hard on Chipresa. At least that was like what it looked like to me, you know?
So, Larry, just looking at the, well, I think I said in your intro where you came in, Benoit, I mean, what was the general feeling while I just look at, where did he finish?
He was 22nd.
Position? He was 22nd. So I guess, was there some degree of disappointment about that? Because he did seem to be on decent form on the day. What was the sort of mood like when you got to the bus?
Yeah, I would say the general sentiment was that of disappointment. But like, you know, why it didn't work out, it's hard to say, you know, like whether it was just legs, whether it was the plan of the team. You know, I know one thing he wasn't pumped about was that we had to do Milano-Torino, and he'd already been on the road from LaGuelia and then like Tirreno straight to Milano-Torino, which we didn't even have really a sprinter that much. So like, you know, we were just kind of there for a really long time on the road, where it's like, you know, I think that's one thing that's a big thing that sometimes we neglect in cycling is like mental freshness is super important too. And that was actually something I wanted to say about the start of Sanremo is like, I don't think the physical efforts at the beginning of the race really matter that much, but staying mentally fresh to be able to fight for the finish makes a huge difference. So I think whatever you can do to just stay chill at the start of that race keeps you mentally fresh for the end when you really need to be in the fight. And I guess like if we look at the macro thing, that was kind of like his sentiment was that like, you know, he wasn't mentally fresh when he got to the race because he'd been away for so long and like, you know, kind of for like a, I don't want to say worthless race, but for him, maybe he didn't see it as a very valuable race in between.
There are two schools of thought on that, though, aren't there, about how you stay fresh. I mean, some people would say that the best way to stay fresh is to stay focused and to prevent your mind from wandering. So maybe if you go into the first half of Milan-San Remo with clear objectives of, I don't know, where you're going to be in the peloton, how you're going to approach it, et cetera, as against... believing that the best way to stay fresh is to let your mind wander as much as it can in a peloton in a big one-day race and not to really stress yourself out. I don't know. I mean, I think we've all had experiences, both sides of that coin. I always think that, you know, mountain biking is a great example of this, how you have to be completely focused if you're riding on a single track or whatever. But that can be quite sort of refreshing and reinvigorating in itself because you, as I say, your mind doesn't have a chance to wander. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is a mountain bike race is like an hour and a half, you know, so it's a bit different than Milan-San Remo, which is 7 hours. You know, I think one thing that we really neglect a lot is just that like the fatigue, trying to focus for hours and hours on end adds to, you know, your physical performance at the end of the race. You know, I think like one thing that like we just neglect quite a lot in racing is that like the physical aspect is really impacted by the mental aspect. And if you don't have both together, I guess, if you don't take both into account, I don't think there's any way you're going to perform. So I think that's it's an important thing to remember.
Lionel, how did you manage to stay fresh for your 100-kilometer ride on Thursday or Friday?
The 100-kilometer ride. Well, how did I manage to stay fresh? I just enjoyed it. I mean, we had a much less of a tailwind compared to the pro riders in the race. I mean, that made it a lot harder for us. Just on that point, though, about, you know, Cosnefroy, I mean, he would have been away for 3 and a bit weeks, wouldn't he? From LaGuelia through Tirreno Adriatico, Milano Torino. And I completely get where you're coming from there, Larry. That kind of, you know, it's going to be the last bastion of old school thinking that, I mean, from an athletic, from a sporting and a tactical perspective, is there anything to be gained from Cosnefroy doing Milano Torino a few days before Milan San Remo? No, there really isn't. But there's that sense of it's a race. We've got to field a team. The logistics of changing the team. You know, would they send him home for a week in between? You know, there's still that kind of I guess that old school sort of mentality of if the rider's in the hotel, everyone's got their eyes on. There's, you know, I'm not saying specifically about Cosnefroid, but, you know, sort of, and there's still that sense from management that, you know, if the riders are around, then they know what's going on, and the sense of togetherness, I suppose. But for the individual, maybe just a little break before the big objective, if it is that much of an objective, might have done him the world of good. Who knows?
For sure, yeah. And the other thing is we didn't do a recon, which everyone knows the roads, but sometimes it can kind of get you into the mindset before the race. So I think that was one thing they thought maybe would be better to do in the future, is like instead of doing a race in the middle of the week, just doing a recon instead. And then you're a little bit more relaxed. But yeah.
I mean, what a shame. You could have just given me a ring, Larry.
I know.
The right-hand turn at the bottom of the Cipressa is really, really quite tight. So just try and be at the front next time.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, perfect.
Well, Larry, first monument of the season under your belt. You are at Isola 2000. We talked about that at the start of the show. Just tell me, I was kind of curious, what is the sort of thinking now of you going to altitude? I mean, it's a bit of a, you've kind of finished the first block, haven't you? And is it a, have you had a few days of sort of coming down? Is it a question of sort of letting go of a bit of the form and the condition to then build up again for the Ardennes, the Giro? Just explain sort of conceptually what is the thinking behind spending time at altitude now.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, spending time at altitude now is for the Giro, but, you know, it also helped me for the Ardennes. So it's just really for like the next block of racing. And so I've already done like 22 or 23 days of racing this year, which is like quite a lot. And so I needed to take like a little bit of a break. So I was at home for like 2 days. That's not very long. After Milan San Remo. And then I was like, okay, you know, anyway, like the first days at altitude, you want to sort of ease into it. So I was planned to take, you know, like, yeah, just, I guess a few days off the bike. So I came up here and I've just been like skiing and hanging out in the mountains, to sort of just, I guess like, yeah, get a mental refresh, like we were just talking about. Before I sort
it's
of like
bleak Isola, isn't it?
Yeah, like, it's not.
Besides, but the Ibex is.
I'll be honest, like today was really beautiful. I mean, blue skies.
Really?
And then honestly, it was nice skiing.
It's a bleak climb. It's not a nice climb up to Isola 2000.
Oh, I think the climb is really nice. I just think the village really? Kind of sucks. I mean, the village is like ugly and from like the 70s or 80s or just the worst time in terms of architecture and everything.
I think there might be at least one bowling alley. I remember that. But it
doesn't
exist
anymore. It's a pretty
unprepossessing looking resort. Oh, okay. That's and a discotheque, I'm sure. But no, the climb, perhaps you like it because it's kind of an American style climb. It's a big road, isn't it? It's a big, wide road.
Yeah, but it's like in the trees. And then, I don't know, it's always changing. It's pretty steep. It's pretty hard. I think it's actually a really nice climb. But yeah.
Okay. So you're up there to get ready for the Giro and you come down in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so I'll try to do 3 weeks here. So yeah, the goal is just essentially to get in as good as form as I possibly can. And I know that if I do a big block at altitude, that's the best way for me to get into the best form I can be. And I think, you know, that'll help me to be really good in the Ardennes and then really help me get ready for the Giro. So that's sort of like my next big objective. So yeah, I think it's the best way to get ready. And I think it's really now, it's almost like a necessity to do if you want to do well in a Grand Tour. So if you look at any of the guys who've been successful in the Grand Tours over the last years, and I don't mean just like GC or something, I mean like the guys winning stages, everything is, you know, everyone's going to altitude. So I think it's just that last few percent that if you want to do well, it's something you need to do.
Many guys up there at the moment. I know you're piggybacking Harry Sweeney's Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we have to say
Sweeney.
Thank you to Harry Sweeney for allowing me to use his Wi-Fi hotspot since my service is not good and the Wi-Fi is not working.
So he's up there. Anyone else?
So right now there's no one else. I know my teammate Geoffrey Bouchard was here last week. And then I know that once Harry leaves, I'll be staying with Joe and Will Barda after they come back from Catalunya. And then Matteo Jorgensen will come up a little bit after that. So yeah, I think there'll be a lot of guys rotating in and out of here.
and Larry. Well, I said it was the first monument of the season done and dusted. I saw you at Paran East, of course. You were right in the thick of the action there as well. You were in the break a couple of days. Just generally, I mean, we did a sort of an episode where we look forward to the season as a whole, and you kind of laid out your goals, didn't you? But you must be relatively pleased with the way things have started. No, you're healthy.
Yeah,
you looked on good form.
You know, I think my form is pretty good. You know, I would have liked to get a result. You know, it's like, it's just all well and good to go on the breakaway, but like the objective of going the breakaway is to like win a race or something, you know? So I wouldn't say I have any results to speak of yet. So that's a bit too bad, but, yeah, it's, I've been there and thereabouts, and, you know, I think it'll set me up well for the races to come. But yeah, I would say I'm like generally happy with how it's gone, but yeah, I guess I would like to, yeah, get a result one of these days. That's that'll be, yeah, the next step.
In the podcast, in the couple of podcasts we did with your friend Joe Dombrowski at the end of last year and the start of this year, we talked a lot about the role of luck, and particularly for riders like you and Joe, who perhaps, you know, you talk about getting a result. You are kind of, you're opportunists. You're going to be looking for results from breaks most of the time. And I remember the second of those breaks at Paris Nice to the Col de la Couillole, seeing that you got into the break, but then just looking at the names in the group and immediately realizing that you were probably doomed, because David de la Cruz was in the break, Kobe Gosens was in a break, I think Mühlberg was in the break. They were all guys who were pretty dangerous on GC, and that just brought home to me how fickle those occasions are, where, you know, someone like you will find yourselves in a break, and through absolutely no fault of your own, nothing that you control whatsoever, that's what your success or failure will hinge on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think like getting a result out of a breakaway has to be sort of like a perfect storm. You know, it's like everything has to work out well. You know, who's in it, you know, what like the GC situation is, who has the jersey, things like that, you know. And so, I mean, I think I even told you at the start of that day that like, yeah, I want to go in the breakaway, but I'm almost sure the breakaway won't win today. It's also like, that was this really, really hard climb. So with the way Pogacar was going, you'd need like at least 4 minutes on him probably at the bottom to try to win. So, yeah, I mean, it's good to get out there. But yeah, I think it's hard, but you never know. It's like the first day I was in the breakaway, there was a moment I actually thought we had a chance. And when I went in that breakaway, I didn't actually think we would have any, you know, sliver of a chance. So some days it just works out and you don't know why. And other days you think it's definitely going to work out and it doesn't. So
the way the racing's going at the moment, it doesn't really favour riders going in breakaways, does it? Because Pogacar, Vingegaard, Roglic, Evenepoel, they're setting their stall out that they're going to contest for every possible win. I mean, we're already seeing it in Catalonia that the spoils are being shared by a smaller and smaller pool of riders, it seems.
Yeah, but better be in the break than try to hold onto their wheel, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and I'm a big time bonus propagandist, evangelist. Okay. I love time bonuses, but it does kind of doom breakaways. I mean, particularly with the advent of these 6 second time bonuses at Paris Nice, for example. I mean, they suddenly became a very attractive prize, yeah. even for the GC guys.
Yeah, that was a
yeah.
That was an interesting addition for sure.
And Larry, just so we talked about your start of the season, just looking at the team so far, you've had a couple of wins. Nance Peters won, he won like Guaya, yeah. Didn't he? And Aurélien Paris-Peintre won a stage of the Tour des Alpes-Maritimes et du Var. A couple of other guys going well. Bouchard's climbing pretty well. Ben O'Connor, he and Ben O'Connor are sort of hovering around the top 10 in Catalunya. And you've got the classics coming up, of course. You've got a big, well, you've got the Belgian contingent for the classics. You've got Van Avermaet, Nars, and the Narsen brothers, and De Wolf. I mean, what's the feeling generally in the team? And tell us a bit about how you kind of sense what the prevailing wind in the team is. You know, do you feel in the WhatsApp group that the team kind of needs a result and management isn't happy or is happy? I mean, how does that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say like a result would be very helpful. You know, I would say the prevailing sentiment or the wind is stagnant at the moment. And, right. You know, it's not a headwind. It's not a tailwind. It's just kind of like, you know, we're kind of like in the middle, but I think, you know, it can go one way or the other. Like you get one big win and all of a sudden, like everything's great. Where if you pass like all the classics and you don't win, then we're in trouble, you know? So it's just kind of like, I think we're in sort of this purgatory right now, and it could go totally one way or the other. But you know, I definitely think like, I mean, I hope it'll go well. I think like Ollie was in some of the best form he's been in a long time in Paris-Nice. Yeah, I think he would have gotten at least a decent result in Sanremo, but he broke his chain on the descent of Poggio when he was in the group. So that was too bad. I think he could get a result in one of the classics, whether it's a podium or what. I think that'd be pretty good for us. I think also Stan is knocking on the door. You know, I think in maybe one of the smaller races, he could do something pretty big. And I think he'll be around maybe the top 10 in some of the bigger ones if he has a good day. So that'll be good. And I'm still pretty confident that Benoit will be able to do a big result in one of the Ardennes. And if he does that, then like all of a sudden, like, were golden, you know? So it's just really, it's really crazy at, I guess, like how fine the line is between success and failure in the sport, you know? It's like all of a sudden, like you get one big win and you just had an amazing season, you know? So so I wouldn't say we're going well or going poorly. We're just kind of like riding that line right now. And hopefully we'll get a big win to push us in the right direction.
I mean, looking at the list of winners so far this season, I think UAE Team Emirates, Soudal Quickstep and Jumbo Visma have got 46 wins between them. That's 46 wins between three teams.
Wow.
I guess what you're saying there is, you know, quality, one quality win is probably worth, you know, half a dozen or so smaller wins. So it's that balance, I guess, between you land a big one and you know, the fact that the team has only got two wins so far would be significantly kind of, you know, relegated in the minds of the team management. But yeah, that, like I say, that trend of just pretty much the three teams dominating does make it hard for everybody else.
Absolutely.
Before we move on, I mentioned in Saturday's episode of Arrivé, Simon Gill's fantastic photo of Matthew van der Poel descending the Poggio. For me, it really was shot of the day, a great photo, and it summed up the race perfectly, didn't it? And a few people got in touch with Simon asking whether he would make it available as a print, and he has done that. And you can buy it framed or unframed in a variety of sizes at simongillphotography.co.uk. I'll also put a link to that in our Substack, the 1101 Cappuccino, which will go out a little bit later on this week. And while I'm promoting various things, the Lionel of Flanders is particularly relevant this week with the Grand Prix E3, Gent-Wevelgem and Dwarsdorf-Vlaanderen coming up. A few years ago, Simon and I went to Flanders and we made the Friends of the Podcast series, The Lionel of Flanders, and it's available to listen to or listen again to if you've already heard it. If you want to become a friend of the podcast, sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, our longest term supporters, of course. Science in Sport fueled our ride last week when we took on the final 98.6 kilometres of the Milan-San Remo course between Spotorno and San Remo, taking in the final five climbs, the three Capi, the Cipressa and the Poggio. My bidons were full of beta fuel, and around half an hour before we reached the Cipressa, I chomped my way through a beta fuel chew just to give myself that extra burst of energy when I needed it. Now, to mark the arrival of the Classics campaign, Science in Sport have started a Strava challenge, the Classic 100, and the challenge is to ride 100 kilometres before March the 31st. So you've still got plenty of time. The challenge ends a week on Sunday, and everyone who completes the challenge will get 20% off Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com. And one lucky winner will be in the velodrome to see the finish of Paris-Roubaix. So if you want to be in with a chance of that prize, you need to sign up to the Strava Challenge, the Classic 100, and you can also join the Science in Sport Global Cycle Club on Strava. Now, much to my annoyance, I realised that my 98.6 kilometre ride, although it got me 98.6% towards the target, it fell outside the qualifying period, which is from March the 18th to March the 31st. We actually rode that just before the challenge began, so I've still got a little bit of work to do. So I need to get a couple of 50 kilometre rides in, or maybe I'll push the boat out and do a 100 kilometre ride at some point in the next couple of weeks, but I fully intend to complete the challenge. Check it out on Strava, and if you want to see the full range of Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com. Our friends at MAP, who are our clothing partner and who designed and made the brilliant Cycling Podcast jersey, have been asking people to share their goals for 2023. The Progress of Progression campaign is designed to inspire people to ride somewhere different or ride somewhere new. And we've also been asking our listeners to share their goals for the coming year. Now, this week, we received a really moving email from friend of the podcast, Sam Hall. Now, Sam's son, Sepp, died from cancer last year, 2 months before his fourth birthday. First of all, our heartfelt condolences to you and your family, Sam, for your loss. Now, Sam is going to ride from Helsinki to Epsom, setting off on May the 28th and taking 20 days to ride up and round the corner into Sweden and then down through Denmark, Germany and across Belgium and northern France before the final leg, which he'll do with friends and family from Tunbridge Wells to Epsom on June the 17th. Why is he riding from Finland to Surrey? Well, Sepp's mother is from Finland and Sepp was born in Surrey, so it seems like the perfect stage race to ride in loving memory of his son. But there's also a serious point to the ride too, because the cycle for Sepp will also hopefully raise £50,000 for the Momentum Children's Charity. Sam writes, believe it or not, Sepp's name took inspiration from the cycling podcast. We were struggling for names, knowing it was a boy, when I heard an interview with Sepp Kuss on the pod circa summer 2018. The better half liked it and the rest is history, he says. Well, I think that's a fantastic ride to aspire to, and, well, very meaningful. And I'm sure the memory of your son will be with you all the way, Sam. I wish you much luck, not just with the ride, but also with raising money for the Momentum Children's Charity. If anyone out there wants to donate to that charity, go to supersep.muchloved.com.
Well, Lionel, earlier in the pod, I called you our de facto Cobble Classics correspondent, delegate, reporter. We've started the Classics campaign, the Cobble Classics campaign, haven't we, really, with Depana today? I mean, well, you could say we started a few weeks ago with Omelu, but this is where it really gets serious this weekend, isn't it? What have we got coming over the next few days, Lionel?
Well, as I said, we've got the Grand Prix E3 on Friday. We've got the Gent Wevelgem on Sunday, then Dwars door Vlaanderen on Wednesday, and then the big one, the Tour of Flanders on Sunday. That's the big week of Flemish classics. And then, of course, hot on the heels of the Tour of Flanders is Paris-Roubaix, and that really does bring the curtain down on the Cobble Classics. But yeah, this is the big fortnight, isn't it?
And what are we all looking forward to? What are going to be the big themes, the big talking points of this classic season? I mean, today I thought we found out a little bit more about what we can expect from Soudal Quickstep. Obviously, at this time of year, they're the main team in the spotlight as far as a lot of people are concerned. There's always some kind of drama, or there's a anxiety, I think, in Belgium and in the team, because the expectation is that they are going to be the number one team and they're going to bring home at least one or two of the big classics. This year, I think the general feeling, also based on performances so far, is that they might be missing a leader, a sort of a talismanic figure, and maybe a fast finisher in particular. We saw today Yves Lampaert was really, well, he brought a water pistol to a gunfight, didn't he, against the likes of Coy and Philipson. And I don't know, chaps, what you think. My sense is we might see that scenario playing out in a few of these Cobble Classics over the next couple of weeks. What do you think?
Just going into this like Cobble Classic season, I just think it's really hard to look past Vanderpool and Van Aert. And I just think like no matter how good of a team like Quickstep has, it's going to be really hard to beat those guys.
Yeah, I think that's right, Larry. I mean, the resumption of the battle between Van Aert and Vanderpool is going to be the story of the next couple of weeks, because they could, between them, win all of these races. And then it's going to be about who gets in there and disrupts that head-to-head battle. I mean, Tadej Pogacar is going to ride some of the Cobble Classics. Sudal Quickstep have got Julian Alaphilippe and Kasper Askren as their kind of most likely riders, but they've not had the ideal spring so far, although Alaphilippe was, he was, as we said in Arrivé, Daniel, he was out of position a couple of times in Milan-San Remo, but got himself back into contention and got a decent result. And then it's, you know, it's the usual suspects, isn't it? I mean, the thing is that the Grand Prix E3 Saxo Classic, as it's now called, is the one that's kind of the de facto pre-tour of Flanders warm-up, isn't it? It's the one they take more seriously these days than Gent-Wevelgem, and we'll probably learn an awful lot more on Friday about how things are going to shape up. We'll maybe see one or two other names sort of put themselves into contention. But I think, as you say, it's the Van Aert, Van der Poel battle that's going to have everybody watching, certainly E3, Flanders and Roubaix, where they'll go head to head.
Yeah, I mean, that said, we know the sort of tectonic plates of this aspect of professional cycling, the classics landscape, they can shift pretty quickly. I mean, this is such a short space of time. Every year I feel like I forget how close together races like Gent-Wevelgem and Paris-Roubaix are. You know, in hindsight, in retrospect, it seems as though this period lasts forever, but actually when you're in the thick of it, it comes and goes very quickly. And we can get to the end of the classic season and completely new names can have emerged as the guy. You know, we were talking a few weeks ago about Arnaud Delis. I was talking about him potentially winning Milan-San Remo. I mean, in 3 weeks' time, we could be talking about him as the budding Van der Poel, or the budding rival to Van der Poel or Van Aert. And, you know, there are other riders who really curious to see over the next few weeks. You know, Matej Mohoric is a guy who, up until last year, I would not have had down as a classic specialist, as a cobble classic specialist, but he was very much in the thick of it last year. Could have won Paris-Roubaix if things had gone slightly differently, and he's going to be back there. And, you know, Bahrain are a team that seem to have numbers at the front of every important race, whether it's a stage race, a mountainous, on mountainous terrain, or in the classics. You know, Fred Wright is still chasing his... Larry thinks Fred Wright's my favourite rider. That's not necessarily the case, Larry, because I'm completely impartial as a journalist. That, yeah. Just because I spoke to Fred Wright a lot of the Vuelta a España last year. But Larry, undeniably, Fred Wright is a guy who is going to be a factor in the classics. He's a very strong boy. He was excellent in Tour of Flanders last year. And who knows... This elusive first win that he's been chasing could come in a big race in the next couple of weeks. Do you not agree? Very possible.
It's very possible. He is a good
Larry, anything else that you... Anything else we should be watching maybe in your team? I mean, you've got the golden oldies of Belgium. I can say that. You probably can't say that. Go on. The Rolling Stones.
No, I mean, I think it's going to be tough. Yeah, tough for Greg because he got the flu... like the week of San Remo. So, you know, that's the only thing I think is going to be a bit tough for our team. So, but maybe we'll see some of the other guys. We actually, one guy that I think will be really good is we have this kid who's like 19 years old. His name is Pierre. Wow, how can I forget his last name? Yeah, I forgot his last name. His front birthday is Pierre. But
his name's Pierre.
Oh, gosh, that's terrible.
Okay.
Gautierat, Pierre Gautierat. And he's gotten a few top tens. He stagiaired at the end of last year. He's like, you know, a second year under 23. And the kid is a machine. He maybe doesn't have the endurance yet, But this kid's going to win a big classic sometime in the next few years. So I think he'll do one or two decent results in some of the races this year. But he'll be someone to look out for. He's really, really good.
Seventh in Le Samin and ninth in Cholet.
So, yeah, it looks
two really reasonable results already, yeah.
Yeah, he's had a good start to the season. From Colmar in the Vosges in Alsace, a new name to me as well. Larry, only just turned 20.
He's legit. He's just like super motivated and super excited to be everywhere. And so, yeah, I think...
Larry, before we recorded the podcast, I was rubbing my hands at the idea, the notion that at some point in your long and distinguished career, you'd been dispatched to the classics, the Cobble Classics, in punishment for something. But it doesn't appear to have been the case. You don't seem to have done it. Surely,
no,
you know,
not really.
3 days of West Flanders or something along those lines. I mean, that should be a rite of passage for everyone.
No, I did have to do Nokere 1 year, and then I was supposed to do Hanzam, but it snowed, so Hanzam was canceled. Well, it also snowed there, so I didn't enjoy it very much. But I did see a guy run into a snowbank and crash, so that was a first for me. And the only time I've seen that in a bike race.
It was hatred at first
really
sight.
The most
Belgian
enjoyable
classics.
Race I've done, but yeah. Yeah, but you know what? I was talking to some of the guys on the team, and I was like, I actually would like to do, you know, like Flanders once, maybe do like E3, something like that. I think I really like doing like the hilly cobbled races. I think actually, like when there's a hilly cobbled stage in a race, I enjoy it, you know? And I think it's something I'm not that bad at. So it's something I wouldn't mind dipping my toes in.
Would it be
one
accurate
time
to
before
say
the end
that
of my career?
Those races have become a lot, should we say, less unpleasant or palatable for a ride? Well,
I'm sure someone who's not suited to that terrain and
those road surfaces in particular, the equipment you have now, the much wider tires, lower air pressures, does it? I would suggest that it's probably less of an absolutely sort of teeth chattering, appalling experience.
This is nonsense. Absolutely.
Well,
nonsense.
Then it was once upon a time.
No, I think the only difference is climbers are realizing that they can also do well in those races, and that's why we're seeing all these guys go to the races. Because like it used to be like, oh, you have to be a big guy to do the cobbles, and now people are realizing like, no, if you're strong, like it doesn't really matter what the terrain is, like you can do well in any
Larry,
race.
You did do the under 23 Paris-Roubaix in 2010. Do you remember anything about that?
Yeah, I didn't finish the. I remember, the funny thing is I wasn't supposed to do it, and the night before someone got sick. And we were sitting in the, I was sitting in the kitchen of like the under 23 national team house, and they're like, oh, well, we don't have anyone. Like, do you want to do it? I was like, well, not really, but I guess, I mean, I'll go, you know, like I might as well give it a try. And I didn't enjoy it very much. So I don't really want to do the real Roubaix.
Taylor Finney won it. Jens de Boucherleur was second. Tim de Klerk seventh. And Yves Lampaert 44th. So, pretty decent riders in that. And you're on a sort of training block now at altitude, but how much time will you set aside in order to watch these races over the next couple of weeks? Will you, you know, try and have an easy day on the big race day so you can be in front of the TV?
I mean, I'll never like change my training plan for it, but I'll definitely try to be in front of the TV whenever I can. You know, I really enjoy watching those races, so. And I mean, usually they finish at a good hour, so usually you're done with training by then, even if you have a long day.
Well, chaps, I think that just about concludes our entertainment today in the podcast. Lots of entertainment to come in the classic season, of course, over the next couple of weeks. Lionel, we haven't got an Arrivée this week, have we?
No, we haven't got an Arrivée this week. That will return with the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. There'll be men's and women's episodes for those classics, and I think also for Liège-Bastogne-Liège at the end of the spring classics campaign. Just one last thing, I suppose is it going to be the last hurrah for a few riders in the Cobble Classics this year? Can we, Alexander Kristoff or Peter Sagan or ZNX D-Bar, will they pull off one last glorious day before the twilight of their career? Or perhaps Greg Van Avermaet hasn't won a race since 2019. Maybe this is the spring to be back on the top step of the podium. My tip for the spring is I think Philippe Ogana is going to win Paris-Roubaix this year. That's my neck on the chopping board.
It's his big goal for the season. That and the World Time Trial Championships are his big goals for the season. Milan-San Remo was a bit of an afterthought. He only decided to do it after things went pretty well for him at Tirreno, I believe. So, yeah. I don't know. I can't see Nepal. Coming back to my very good point about equipment, I think a rider like Ganna, who is a bit of a... he's a bit agricultural... over cobbles, or he might be, I would suggest that him on, I don't know, some 19 millimeter rims or whatever they used to ride back in the day, would have struggled more than he will on 30 millimeter rims and 30 millimeter tires.
This is proof that your running career has completely deadened any knowledge of cycling whatsoever.
Absolute fag packet classics punditry. Anyway, Charles, on that,
very polite of Larry not to tell you what a fool you are.
On that indecorous note, I think we will say goodbye to Larry. Larry, wish you a very happy time at altitude. Send us some Ibex pictures if you come across any. And then don't speak before...
Thanks,
no, we
guys.
Will speak to you. Larry, we're going to try and get you on during, before, or just after the Ardennes Classics, because I'm sure you will have some insight that you'll be able to give us from those races. And we'll definitely be seeing you and hearing from you a lot at the Giro. So, Larry, good evening and thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
See you later.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.